I'm Tiffany Gerber, and I'm here interviewing Katie Bowman at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire on Wednesday, March 25th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We'll start with our first question. So basically, I'd like to begin by asking you some basic background information.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And like you said, your place of birth was Rochester, Minnesota, and you were born August
4th, 1983.
Thank you. And what is your race?
White Caucasian.
And your ancestry or ethnicity?
German and Swedish.
Okay. How many male and or female siblings do you have?
One male sibling.
Okay. What is your birth order in the family then? Oldest or youngest?
I'm the oldest.
What is the name and occupation of your partner or spouse?
My partner is John Hall, and he is a firefighter in St. Paul.
And do you have any children?
No.
No. Okay. That's no grandchildren.
No.
Where did you attend school, and what degrees have you earned?
Okay. I did my undergrad at UW-Eau Claire. I got a BA in English Literature and a minor in Women's Studies. Graduated in 2006. Then from 2006 to May 2008, I went to graduate school in Women's Studies at Minnesota State University in Mankato.
Okay. Is there anything else about maybe your general background that you think is important for us to know?
I'm a committed feminist, and that's sort of the perspective I come from in all my work.
Sure. Okay. Great. So now we're going to kind of switch into stories from childhood and adolescence.
Oh, my.
Our first question is, describe your relationship with your parents and your brother when you were growing up.
I felt like it was a really positive relationship. I felt like I got a lot of sort of trust and support from my parents. My brother and I didn't always get along when we were kids. You know, he thought I was kind of nerdy, and so he would like not kind of claim me. You know, like he would be like, okay, she's a dork, she's my sister. You know, I don't want to deal with her. But then as we grew up, through middle school, I guess it was probably after middle school, we really got closer. And my brother's actually married now. He's 18 months younger than I am. So ever since we sort of went to high school, we've always been good friends since. And my parents are married and have been for like 35 years or something. And always their sort of healthy marriage, I think, was helpful to the amount of nurturing that we got.
Sure. Great. Can you tell me about the community and neighborhood where you grew up?
Eau Claire, Wisconsin. It was sort of a semi-rural community. We're on the south side of town of Washington, and it was really small neighborhood surrounded by a lot of fields. It was sort of one of those developments that happened and nothing ever really accumulated around it, you know. So I think the hope was that something would happen around it, but never really did. And so we always, you know, like played in the fields and in the woods and all that kind of stuff because we felt like, you know, sort of rural.
Sure. Can you describe how your family was or was not connected to the community?
Well, we were sort of an isolated family, really, if you think about it that way. My parents didn't do a whole lot in terms of social movements or organizations. I was confirmed as a Lutheran. We were sort of involved in at least going to church sort of reluctantly. All of us, we all come, like, woke each other up on Sunday and said, let's go to church, do we really want to do that? My mom was involved in, my dad's a physician, she was involved in, like, the medical auxiliary for a while and did some sort of philanthropy through them and stuff, but really, our connection to the community was more through family because we are a long line of Bowmans in the Eau Claire area. So a bunch of Swedes, back in the day, like, settled here. And so we have many generations of family that have lived here before us. And so everybody in my family is pretty well acquainted with Eau Claire.
Sure, sure. Okay. Who had power and privilege in your community, and how did that affect your family?
That's a good question. Certainly, our population was pretty homogenous, pretty white, pretty middle to upper middle class. And that, kept me in my comfort zone for a really long time, until I sort of developed a feminist consciousness where I started sort of rejecting the status quo of what, I had come to know as reality. But I guess people that really enjoyed the most power and privilege were white. Were men, were middle class, and middle age, actually, also. And that was apparent in my family, the way that our family was structured around my dad as the ultimate authority. It was also structured in my extended family, who also sort of shared the same values. It was expressed through the church that I attended and was confirmed from. It was just very, it was not overtly oppressive, but there was definitely a lot of male privilege and white privilege exercised.
Sure. What values did you learn from your family and other people and institutions in the community?
Well, my family, you know, like I said, I was sort of within this comfort zone of being privileged, you know, and so I was able to enjoy and reap the benefits of my white privilege, of my upper middle class privilege, and, you know, so that's how I was sort of socialized, to understand that as normative and as valuable. And, but, you know, it wasn't long into my years in school that I sort of began to understand that, you know, our large house on the outskirts of town wasn't necessarily like how everybody lived, you know. It took me a while to figure that out. Like when I visited other people's houses, you know, in the Third Ward or in Putnam Heights or whatever, you know, just sort of modest ranch style homes or whatever, and I was like, gosh, you know, we live differently. We're different. And, you know, I also had friends that were people of color. We had a lot of Hmong students attending my elementary and middle schools, and I befriended quite a few of them. And so sort of understanding how their family, how their family's reality was different from mine was really sort of an integral part of becoming, I guess, a feminist and becoming interested in celebrating difference and understanding difference and sort of negotiating difference. So, yeah, that's where it kind of came from, I guess.
Okay. What occupations did your parents pursue?
My mom was originally a nurse, and then, well, she was educated here at UW-Claire. We're townies. and got a nursing degree, and then my dad was working on his medical degree for that whole same time period. So he went to school and figured out he wanted to be an anesthesiologist, the, you know, gas man. Put him on and knock him out. And so they sort of traveled around to different places where he'd do his residency. He did that, like, in Rochester and Madison. And so they did that for a while. And then after my dad got through medical school, they decided to have babies. And I was the first. And so that's when my mom decided she wanted to be a full-time mom and not a nurse anymore. So she's still sort of pursues that aspect of life, and my dad is still an anesthesiologist.
Okay. Can you give an example of how gender, race, ethnicity, and social class were important in building your understandings of yourself and society?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've talked a lot about the privileges that I benefited from as a kid and growing up and still benefit from. And, like, well into college, it was really hard for me to confront those privileges. Like, I never really wanted to talk to people about class because it made me feel uncomfortable. You know, I'd be like, well, you know, maybe, you know, I had this sort of guilt thing going on, which, you know, in hindsight, it wasn't a very effective way of dealing with class privilege. But that's what happened. And same with white privilege. You know, I started reading stuff like the Combahee River Collective statement or, you know, Gloria Motto, something about the problem makes it hard to name. And all these texts that were really integral to feminism and to sort of womanism, black feminism, multicultural feminism, I was really sort of, like, reluctant to understand them or to appreciate them because I just didn't get it and still struggle, I think, you know, admittedly. I think it's one of those things that you never just, like, get over. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm over my white privilege now. Like, now I'm better. It's never like that, so I guess that's one of the ways that the privileges I had have also been really troubling.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have any memories of being discriminated against or seeing others who were victims of discrimination?
Definitely. Definitely. You know, I guess some of my first feelings of discrimination for myself were, you know, when I was like, you know, you asked me about my neighborhood. I should have probably included this in that discussion. But my neighborhood was predominantly, like, little boys. And so I was, like, one of the little girls, like, among the little boys. And I just kind of wanted to do everything that they did and, you know, just participate on the activities that they were doing, you know, kickball, ball tag, you know, Nintendo, video games. I want to be good at that stuff. I want to be competitive. And, you know, I was rarely picked first for those things. I was really, you know, really valued as a player. And, you know, perhaps I was less able. I don't really know, but I wasn't, you know, so it was one of those things where I always felt alienated. And, you know, if I ever hurt, like, I have this bad, awkward thing, right, where if I'm doing athletics, like, I accidentally hurt people when I'm doing it. And so Richard, one of my neighbors, I would always, like, accidentally hurt him. Like, I'd throw the ball at him, and it would just hurt, and he'd start crying, and everybody would be like, Katie, how could you hurt that boy? You know, like, it was really troubling to them to see, like, a girl being menacing. And so it was already sort of in the back of my mind, like, why is, you know, what's the disconnect here?
Mm-hmm.
And then I got really angry when I started figuring out about gender, that, you know, I was like, girls are so, you know, for a long time I said, girls are so stupid. Like, why do they like girly stuff? I don't even want to be friends with girls because they're just annoying and they value all these, like, superficial things and they're mean to each other and, like, boys are just much simpler and, you know, all this stuff. But it came from a really sexist place and a really, like, stupidly gendered place. And so it wasn't until later that I really understood that it was discrimination, that girls weren't the problem, that girls weren't stupid for, you know, behaving the way that they did, but they were socialized that way. And so, yeah, that discrimination piece was, it wasn't until long after that I sort of articulated it as such, I guess.
Sure, sure. What significant historical events do you recall most clearly from your childhood, and how have they affected you throughout your lifetime?
Historical events. Gosh, you know, there were certainly a lot of things that happened. I think the most, I mean, it speaks to my age, would be the 9/11 attack. You know, I was in high school. You probably were somewhere around that age, too, I guess. And I was sitting in a sociology class, and we had the TV on for some reason. I think we were, like, maybe going into a video or something like that. It happened to be on, which was really bizarre. And Mr. Fisher, my sociology teacher, was like, wait a second, like, I just got word from some other faculty member that, you know, something's happening and we need to watch. So we watched, like, CNN or something and watched these planes sort of go into the World Trade Center. And I didn't understand what was happening. None of us really did. You know, we're like, oh, why are they crashing like that? That's stupid or whatever. And then it wasn't until afterwards that we realized that it was, you know, an attack and that, what we had witnessed was, like, monumental, sort of one of the only attacks on American soil and all that kind of stuff. So that was, like, a really, that event, I really think, was sort of the catalyst for a lot of conservatism and nationalism and stuff in this country that was ultimately an affront to feminism. And so it was really, that was a turning point event. It was all of a sudden after that happened, it was like, you better be on guard as a feminist because, you know, you've got sort of fundamental Christian right people sort of starting to identify their religion with this country and sort of there's a slippage between nationhood and, like, religion and all that kind of stuff. And so that was really big for me. So then when I was in college after that, it was, like, very clear to me that, you know, this patriotism, this newfound patriotism was very sort of steeped in ethnocentrism and ugliness. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel good about it at all, yeah.
Sure. Looking back at your childhood, would you have anticipated that you'd become a feminist later in life?
I don't think so. I don't think I had a clue what it was. And I do remember hearing the word, you know, feminist when I was a kid and sort of resisting it because I thought, well, why do we need feminism? I remember even having this conversation with my dad when I was little, you know, like little, like middle school little. You know, I was like, Dad, why do we need feminism? I mean, we've got everything. Women are equal and, you know, we've got everything we need and, you know, I can do anything I want, you know, because my parents always told me, you can do whatever you want. Well, that's, you know, great, thanks, but, you know, it's not necessarily the reality. So I guess, no, in hindsight, I don't think that as a kid or as my kid self that I would have projected myself as a feminist later in life because I just didn't see what it meant, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. We're going to move from that topic into crafting feminist identities.
Cool.
Can you describe your educational path after high school? I know you kind of mentioned, you know, your undergraduate and whatnot, but...
Yeah, I knew right away that I needed to go to school, so I didn't take any time off. I just went directly from Memorial High School in Eau Claire to UW-Eau Claire. You know, I was, like, really comfortable here. I liked it here. And I had just developed a relationship with the guy that I'm still dating. And so I knew I kind of wanted to be around here, and I've shown horses my whole life, too, so I had the horses here, I had the boyfriend, I had the parents, I had everybody here. Went to UW Eau Claire for 4 years, got done in 2006, and then directly moved on to grad school, because, again, it was something I knew I wanted to do, I knew it would make me a more viable sort of player, you know, in the community. Mm-hmm. And so did Women's Studies, MS, Master of Science in Mankato, Minnesota State University.
Can you describe your occupational path then after you graduated from Mankato?
After high school or after Mankato?
After Mankato.
Okay. Yeah, so after I graduated from, with my graduate work, I went to, well, actually, they kept me on board there as adjunct faculty for a semester or a year? A year? Yeah, maybe it was a year. No, it was a semester. Okay. So it was a semester. I graduated in May 2008, and then, like, throughout the summer, I worked on this Women in Spirituality conference. It's like a regional, you know, it's a pretty well-attended conference at MSU. Totally out of my, like, interest zone. Like, I have, like, zero interest in spirituality, basically. But it was a really good opportunity for me to, you know, hone my organizing skills. I mean, it was like 700 people, so I had to really figure out where to put the, you know, the presenters and what to do with the attendees and all the stuff that goes along with it, and procuring and maintaining a keynote speaker was very difficult. So I did that until December 2008, and then that fall semester, September through December of 2008, I also taught adjunct at MSU, a couple classes. Then after that, I came back here in December 2008, a couple months ago, and knew I wanted to pursue a job in higher ed or advocacy or some kind of feminist thing. And so I put out a bunch of applications, and I ended up getting a position here with Susan Terrell, teaching adjunct in the third wave class. And then also at the Bridge to Hope in Menominee, which is like a shelter for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, as a family violence advocate, as a legal advocate. I've had all sorts of titles in just like a couple of months.
What was the name of the shelter in Menominee?
The Bridge to Hope.
Okay.
Yeah. So it services down in Pepin County. So actually there's a satellite office in Durand too, which I might have some participation in, but yeah, right now I'm currently the legal advocate there, and I currently teach 3 credits
the
here.
Legal advocate, huh?
Yes, which is weird.
Do you have any kind of a law background?
No.
Or do you need to?
It would be helpful. It would be really helpful. I just got kind of thrown into that position because there's been a huge sort of shift of employees and sort of their organization, their as management and stuff. They're really shifting things around. And so a bunch of people have left. A bunch of people have come in as new staff, like me. And when I started on, I started, like, as their family advocate, which I was more comfortable with because I was like, oh, that's, like, a whole variety of people. That could be anybody. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody's got some kind of family, arguably. I'm like, I can do that. But then the legal advocate left, and they really needed somebody to fill that position. And so they were like, will you do this? And I said, okay. And so basically it's a matter of reading a whole lot of legal sort of statutes from Wisconsin and
sure.
stuff like that. That's basically, it's just a whole lot of reading and paperwork.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
When and how are you awakened to social inequalities based on gender, race, and social class, sexual orientation, and all the other layers of identity?
Okay, so when and how are you awakened? What do you mean by that?
Was there, you know, a certain instance where you saw something happen, or maybe something that happened nationally, or even within a course, something that was taught that made you realize that not everybody is equal, not everybody, like your dad said, can do whatever they want.
Yeah, right. No, okay, I get it. So I think that moment for me, it was more of like a process. It was less of like an aha moment that people have as much as it was a process. I had a bunch of friends in high school that were really into Ani DeFranco, and you know, at first I was like, oh, I don't listen to that stuff, like, I don't know that, you know, I, you know, whatever. And so I started listening to a lot of Ani, I started listening to a lot of Bob Marley, and some other sort of, like, you know, Rage Against the Machine, all those, like, sort of, whatever, sort of rebellious, anti-establishment, you know, groups, musical groups. So music, I guess, really prompted me to start seeing things that I hadn't seen before that have been invisible to me. I finally started articulating what it meant to be discriminated against as a woman, but I also started to figure out that there was, you know, from, for example, Rage Against the Machine, you know, it was about, you know, also being sort of disenfranchised as people of color and as poor people. So I was starting to make connections about social injustice through, I guess, through that music and through the conversations I was having with my friends in high school.
Sure. Okay. That's an interesting take on that. What memories do you have of your first encounters with a feminist or the subject of feminism?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first memory I have of it is, like I told you about that conversation I had with my dad when I was in middle school. I don't know what prompted me to start that conversation with him, but, you know, I must have heard something on the news or by a friend or something about the word feminist, and I asked my dad, I'm like, why do we need, you know, feminism? We've got everything that we could possibly have. You know, women are equal, and we're fine, and all this stuff. So that was my first sort of really primordial and not very well-developed understanding of feminism.
Sure. What resistance, if any, did you face from people you cared about when you did become a feminist?
Well, it's sort of weird. You know, I came from a perspective that was sort of nestled in comfort and sort of basking in privilege, I guess you could say. And a lot of my family expresses pre-conservative political ideology. So, not surprisingly, for a while in high school, before, you know, all this Anita Franco stuff, you know, I was out there, like, picketing for Bush. And, you know, I couldn't vote yet, but I was out there like, yeah, you know, Bush, whatever, 2000. And I had really no idea about where that put women or anything. I had no clue. I was just like, yeah, no. People need to work for their money, and I had all this sort of, like, idea that everybody was on the same playing field, and, like, if you didn't work hard, you weren't going to make money, and if, you know, it's very sort of just very simplistic thinking, and so once I got sort of over that and figured out that, you know, there was this sort of multi-level issue of interlocking oppression, and, you know, it's not that developed in terms of what I was thinking, but, you know, I started listening to Zach De La Roca and Ani and Bob Marley or whatever, and started figuring out that it was an issue. So when I started embracing that ideology, that's when I sort of started seeing resistance. And it wasn't even as much against me, because I wasn't as vocal about it with my family, because I just didn't want to go there, and I still don't usually. I just am like, you're not going to, we're just not going to see, you know, we're going to clash. There's no sense in bringing this. It's just going to cause an argument. So, you know, there was a lot of sort of family mudslinging, if I did bring anything up. My brother was really the one that received the brunt of the sort of resistance and anger and sort of backlash, because he was going to college, just, you know, right around the same time I was, because we were just 18 months apart.
Mm-hmm.
And he was involved he went to Northland College up in Ashland, which is, you know, very sort of liberal arts, environmental liberal arts is what they basically call themselves. And so he'd come home with all these ideas about, like, sustainability and globalization and pollution and what it means to participate with, you know, like, the man and being on the grid versus being off the grid and all that stuff. And that's where I, like, really saw the resistance, because he was very vocal about it. So that sort of taught me to not do that with my family. Instead, I would be very vocal on campus. That's sort of where I went to vent and really sort of say what I thought. And so, of course, you know, rallying for pro-choice or doing whatever, you know, being down at Planned Parenthood, rallying outside of there and making, you know, the impact that, you know, the women attending here are not villains, they're okay. You know, we had people all the time coming up to us with rosaries and trying to pray for us. Or, you know, there was a woman that pulled up in her Suburban one time with her ailing mother, grandmother, and said, what would you do with this woman? Would you euthanize her? Would you take her life? Like, comparing it to the pro-choice politics. It was just very, there's a lot of really crazy, irreverent, and illogical arguments that were, you know, confronting us all the time.
Sure.
Yeah.
Excuse me. You talked about, you know, becoming a feminist was a process for you. Mm-hmm. Anything that you'd like to add in describing that process as you came to identify yourself as a feminist?
It was largely shaped, you know, finally when I, you know, I talked about that musical stuff. Like, mm-hmm. music really informed my feminism in the really early stages. You know, I was like 16 or 17. I was like, yeah, yeah, you know, like, this is hardcore. I feel like a rebel. And then, so by the time I went to UW-Eau Claire, I already had that sort of beginning of a consciousness of feminism. And so I knew right away that I wanted to go to women's studies. I had no idea really what it entailed, but I just had a feeling that it would be sort of congruent with what I was starting to understand. And it was. So the first class I ever took was Women in Contemporary Literature with Stephanie Sievers, S-I-E-V-E-R-S. And she was a German national and was sort of here for a little while. I don't know, did you ever meet
her? I did not.
She's in the English department. So it was one of those cross-listed English women's studies 200-level courses. And I just remember feeling like, hello! Like, some of the people that were resistant to the ideas, I was like, hello! Like, this is for real. Like, quit being stupid. This is, you know, this is happening, and being very frustrated and starting to, like, come to terms with my anger about it and stuff like that. And so it was like, that class was sort of a catalyst for taking more women's studies, and then, you know, I all of a sudden I'm like knee-deep in women's studies and like the president of College Feminist. So it was like this crazy transformation over the course of the end of my high school and the beginning of my college years. My sophomore year, I was like full-fledged, like out on the campus mall and in town, like, you know, with holding signs and all that stuff.
Sure. Okay. What does the meaning, the feminist statement mean, or the personal is political? What does that hold for you?
That is such a good question. It means a lot to me because it means, you know, I'm sort of grappling with some generational conflict between the second wave and the third wave, and I think the personal is political is one of those sort of feminist paradigms that brings us together as feminists, because the second, you know, while there's, I think, like, a lot of animosity between second wavers and third wavers, it's one of those phrases that was sort of coined in the second wave, and we still live by it, third wave, and for me personally, it's one of those things where if I don't, let's put it this way, it's one of those things where it sort of insinuates that whatever change I'm doing is political change. So even if it's a personal thing, like me sitting around with a couple of friends talking about events that happened to us, like consciousness raising, you know, and just kind of talking and verbalizing things that otherwise were not said. I mean, to me that's personal, but once you figure out that it's part of a system, it becomes really quickly political. On the other hand, political events that I've participated in are very much personal to me. So it's one of those sort of reversible phrases that it's just really important to me because it's so much a part of our history and also our present.
Sure. What have been the greatest challenges you have faced as a feminist?
I think frustration with this idea that we always have to prove that, like, discrimination exists. You know, so it just seems like all the time, like, for example, environmentalists, like, they don't have to prove that, like, there's pollution. Like, there is pollution, period. You know, people finally have sort of, and that is not a given. I mean, it's been a long time in the making that people started to finally believe that, and some people still don't believe global warming is happening and all that. Fine. But for the most part, I would say, like, in general, people understand and sort of have resigned themselves to the fact that, like, human beings have produced pollution, and, like, the green movement is probably a positive asset to making that change. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, with feminism, it's like we kind of always are going back to square one and teaching people about, yeah, so discrimination exists. People are like, no, 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 it's not. It's, you know, just like my original reaction was, yeah, no, we have everything we need. We're fine. We're good. There's nothing wrong here. You know, that kind of mentality of denial and just really clinging to the status quo and not wanting it to change and really dragging your heels and planting in solidly and saying, no, I will not go there with you. That's really frustrating to me. You know, whether it's students that I'm working with, whether it's friends, family members, I mean, that's frustrating. You know, that they sort of it's also sort of a personal affront to me, because I'm like, no, I know that it exists because I have lived it, and you know, and it's a really hard thing to try and confront.
What do you consider the greatest achievements of feminism over the past 25 years?
The past 25 years, so that would put us, like, to the 80s. Mm-hmm. I think that, I think that some of the things that we can really appreciate feminism for in the last 25 years are sort of, like, more intangible than perhaps in the last 50 years. You know, like, the second wave, there were very, like, clear battles fought and awards won. Sort of like, you know, Title IX, Title VII, all that stuff. Like, or, you know, some of the legislation that was happening, Roe v. Wade, you know, all that stuff was, like, a very easy to pinpoint landmark events. I think in the last 25 years, it's been a little bit less straightforward in terms of, like, a linear progression of, like, or chronological progression of, we won this, now we've gone to the next battle. It's not like that anymore, I don't think. It's more like ideologies are sort of developing, and for example, it's more commonly accepted that, you know, men can be sort of active participants as fathers, you know, and must be in order for children to sort of, you know, thrive. And not even for that reason, really. It's more about sort of adjusting gender and making gender roles more equitable. I mean, I think it's more commonly held belief that men ought to take the sort of more of the lion's share of domestic work, and women ought to have the opportunity to do more public work. So I think that's one of the sort of major ideologies that has shifted. I also think that you know, certainly education is a big place where we're seeing change for women. I mean, you know, we're seeing women entering colleges at larger rates than men nationally, and that's really important, you know. I don't know, is UW-Eau-Claire still like that?
Mm-hmm.
So it's more...
I know.
Yeah, higher women's population than men. And I think that's really exciting because we're seeing women enter higher education, and that also suggests that that they're looking sort of past high school, they're looking past their limited choices that we had before. I mean, there is absolutely nothing wrong with being a mother and choosing motherhood, but the idea is that that's not the only choice we want to have. So the fact that so many women are entering higher education, it's really, to me, it makes me optimistic that women are seeing more options for themselves outside of motherhood and sort of traditional domestic, you know, care, nurturing roles, that kind of thing.
What do you think are the most important challenges feminism must overcome in this century?
Yeah, that's a good one. I think that, you know, one of the biggest dilemmas that we face as sort of the third wave, let's call it that for argument's sake, that we are in the third wave, is that, like, you know, like, it's sort of more based on the individual, and that makes good sense, because this whole idea of sisterhood and sort of unity, it sort of negates the issue of difference. And so I think what we've done with more attention on the individual and identity politics is really important, because we're sort of moving towards an understanding of feminism that is inclusive and that doesn't sort of... It's not sort of like white girls only club anymore. This isn't to say that there weren't people challenging that paradigm in the second wave. There certainly were. That's where womanism came from. That's where, you know, so a lot of these really fundamental comedy, you know, all these other texts came from. But I think now we've got a better handle on celebrating difference, really understanding diversity beyond face value, and really grappling with the difficulty of negotiating difference. That brings forth the problem of, where's the unity? So if we have this emphasis on difference and individualism, identity politics, where does that put us as a movement? We're a lot less visible now than we used to be because of that reason. You know, we don't have large organizations heading the country anymore. We have a lot more small sort of identity-specific organizations. So I guess the strength of that is, of course, that we're recognizing difference and allowing people to flourish in ways that they wouldn't otherwise be flourishing. But on the other hand, it's difficult because there's not a visible united front, and so people sort of are made invisible.
Sure.
By that.
Sure.
Hello.
Okay. The next part is kind of going to be open-ended. With looking at your experience at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and specifically the Women's Studies program, mm-hmm. especially graduating with the minor at the time, and you graduated 2006, so you didn't get to see it become a major, but now actually working within the department. Can you tell me about your experience, what you think of the department?
I love this department. I believe in it, and it's just really, it's been such an important part of my own personal and political development that it's just very dear to me. The issue of the minor and the major, I'm just super excited that a major exists. I would have been a major if there would have been an opportunity for me to do that. You know, as it were, I ended up graduating with like 64 credits in women's studies and, you know, a little bit more in English Lit. It was kind of like, you know, six one way and a half dozen another. So it was one of those things where I felt like I had a really good, strong equivalent of a major, and I believed so much in what I had done, like with those many, many credits in women's studies, that I was just really excited when there was already some action towards the major when I left. So that was exciting. And, you know, it's interesting because I'm coming here from, MSU, Minnesota State University in Mankato. They had the first ever master's degree in women's studies in this country. And so coming from that program, and so it was only, that was in the 70s. So it was shortly thereafter that they developed a major. And then they sort of kind of went in the reverse. They kind of like developed a major and they sort of like developed a minor and all this stuff. But, you know, their big sort of pinnacle move was to have the master of science. Here it's been sort of the opposite. It's like, we started small, you know, we started as, you know, certificate and minor, and we're sort of growing. And I think that kind of growth is really exciting because it illustrates that there's a need and a want for, among students, for women's studies. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this program develops as a department, you know, to see how, if it's major students sort of help it to become larger. Because I think that could definitely happen. It'd be great to see some graduate courses offered in women's studies and, you know, and some people doing graduate work here, because I think we do have a really strong program, and it's a very exciting place to be. This campus, I think, is really conducive to women's studies, at least in my experience it was, because there was Progressive Student Organization and Association, I guess, rather, PSA, and the College Femmes when I was here, and stuff like that. We did a lot of collaboration. There's always somebody visible on campus. You know, Flipside had just started when I was here, so it was like always some kind of visible progressive movement happening. So I think this is a really good place to be, weirdly, Eau Claire, if you want to do feminist work.
What's the importance, you were kind of touching on it a little bit, but what's the importance of having a women's studies program here?
What's important about it is that, you know, we're interdisciplinary, and that's really important. There's not a whole lot of programs that are like women's studies because of our sort of uniquely interdisciplinary nature. I mean, you know, coming out of English, arguably English does some grappling with, like, you know, social issues, psychological issues, gender issues. You know, they're arguably sort of interdisciplinary, but, you know, the focus always comes back to literate and literary studies. You know, here it's like, you know, in women's studies, I'll give you the example of at MSU. When I applied there, I found that there were faculty that had PhDs in history, sociology, women's studies, and literature. So I was like, wow, four different tenure-track faculty members with four different PhDs, they're all sort of teaching in the same department. Like, how strange. You know, and part of it was really wonderful because it was interdisciplinary. Part of it was kind of frustrating because I had to write papers in ASA, APA in Chicago. But here, I see that also being a strength because it's like people come from all sorts of different perspectives. You know, our group of faculty happens to be a little bit more, strangely, like Victorian. I don't know why. We just happen to have, like, a lot of Victorian studies people in our department, and that's fine. But what I do see is, like, the possibility for all sorts of different opinions contributed here. And there's hardly any other department that could prepare you in that sort of a well-rounded sense for your future in terms of jobs, employment, and also sort of mentally and emotionally understanding the world, how it exists, you know?
Sure. I guess, are you planning on staying here?
I am hoping to. You know, I like Eau Claire, and I like working adjunct here. I'd really like to get my PhD so I can be a little bit more of, a heavy-hitting contributor, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I am hoping to stay in the area.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add about the Women's Studies program here? Anything about its impact, its history, its future? Anything?
Sure, yeah. I mean, like I said, this program is just so important to me that, you know, some of the classes that are offered here, I mean, it's arguably kind of a small program compared to some other universities, but I think one of the strengths also is that we have some really interesting special topics courses offered, and so I was prepared in a whole variety of fields. Again, it goes back to that interdisciplinary thing. You know, I was prepared to talk about ecofeminism and Victorian women's studies African-American women's literature. I mean, I was prepared in all sorts of different areas because this department is so diverse in its course offerings. Also, sort of the way that we cross-list here, I think, is pretty cool. It offers, you know, different ways to receive credit in women's studies as well as to, you know, acquire different kinds of knowledge. And, you know, everybody that I've ever really worked with in this department has been very supportive and very, they believe in it, you know? And I think that's probably the biggest driving force. You know, whenever we were doing college fem stuff in my undergrad, you know, there was always sort of a helping hand, or at least words of support from the faculty. You know, they believed it. They were like, yeah, you do your activism. You know, they were committed to that as well as to the academic part of things. So I think that is a really good combination, you know, to embrace the activism and also encourage academics. I think you can hardly do one without the other in women's studies when you do that here. So, yeah, I love it here. I can't say enough good things about it. I love it.
No problem. Well, that concludes my interview.
Wow.
Thank you.